Thank you to the founding sponsor of Undivided, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com. Today, after 2 years of strict mandates, could the libertarian movement be the answer?
We often convince ourselves that we're free. We're actually just really well domesticated at this point.
The party's nominee for vice president, Spike Cohen, makes his case. And we discuss some of the more controversial aspects of the party's platform.
As a Seattleite, I'm thinking, I feel like I've seen drug decriminalization in action, and I don't like the result of it.
You've seen a local level drug decriminalization where the drug war still exists and creates all those things.
Plus, I spent time this week in speaking with political crowds, what I learned about the importance of being able to communicate with people you don't agree with. Cruz, welcome to the Undivided Podcast. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being interested in giving common sense a comeback. I spent my weekend trying to do that. One of the nice things since I quit my job in corporate media is I've been able to accept a lot more invitations to speaking engagements. When I was at Fox, we weren't allowed, and for good reason, to accept any invitations to speak at any events that were considered politically partisan. And that makes sense to me. I don't believe that mainstream journalists should be doing that just because of the optics of the situation. But now that I have an independent podcast, and now that I have been more forthright about my political beliefs, being a moderate independent, I've been accepting a lot of speaking engagements, mostly for Republicans. I haven't been invited by any Democrats to speak. So it's like, well, I don't know why. I'd love to. I'm happy to speak to Democrats if they'll have me. But Republicans have invited me to quite a few things. And then also this weekend, I spoke at the Washington State Libertarian Party's annual convention. I'll get to that in a moment. But I want to start with the Republican event I was at over the weekend. It was the Okanagan County Lincoln Day dinner. All the Republican county parties have a Lincoln Day dinner every year, and I've been invited to speak at a couple of them. I have one out on the far western side of the state coming up soon. So I was in Okanagan County. Beautiful out there, by the way. If you have not been up to like the Chelan area and all along the Columbia River there in Washington State, it is paradise. That's where I want to retire and live out my years, because it is, I always say it looks like the front of a Hidden Valley Ranch bottle come to life. It's just so, so beautiful. Anyway, had a great time at the Lincoln Day dinner. I was the master of ceremonies, and the keynote speaker was Tiffany Smiley, who's a United States Senate candidate for the Republicans. And then there were a number of elected leaders and candidates there to speak as well. And I kind of wrestled with, you know, do I tell the crowd that I'm not a Republican? Some of them might already know that if they listen to the podcast. And I mean, the organizers of the event know that I'm not a Republican, but that I have a lot of issues that I agree with Republicans on. But there was something brought up during Tiffany Smiley's keynote speech that I thought was very important. And it kind of speaks to the heart of what we try to do on Undivided. She had mentioned, and she told everybody who was sitting in the crowd, that next time they come, to bring five friends. And that's how the party is going to grow, to have everybody who's there, who's dedicated, bring five friends the next time they come to any sort of Republican function. And she got done speaking. And what I told the crowd in follow-up is I said, you know, Tiffany told you to bring five friends next time, but you have to make sure that at least some of those friends are not Republicans. And that's the key. For the Republican Party in Washington State, which has basically lost any measurable amount of power, it's not enough just to make sure that your fellow Republicans turn their ballots in. You have to make a concerted effort, particularly in 2022, and I'll talk about some of the things going on right now that I think make it logical for moderates to side with Republicans this year. But especially in 2022, you have to make a concerted effort to try to bring in people from outside the party to expose them to some of the things that you're prioritizing and that you're talking about. And you might say, well, duh, we're always trying that. But I don't know if they are. I don't know that parties are actively trying to speak to people outside their base. It seems that the more combative, the more hyperpartisan that politics become, we just hunker down in our echo chambers. We don't want to be challenged. We don't want to have to explain or answer logical questions about our beliefs and our ideologies. And so you have this whole swath of voters in the middle who are kind of trying to find their own path. And by and large, they're relying on the media to help inform them about the issues of the day, which I would argue is sometimes not the best way to be informed of the issues of the day. And so I ended my time at this Lincoln Day dinner by telling them, you know, bring five friends, but make sure a couple of them aren't Republicans. And what I made sure to note is that I am not a Republican. I said, I'm not a Republican. I'm a moderate independent. But why do you think I'm here? I'm here because I've dedicated my career to giving common sense a comeback in the media and in politics. And I would not be here if I didn't believe that Republicans have common sense on their side right now. And on most important issues right now, I truly believe that. On public safety, on policing. We've now had two officers killed in Washington state in the past 2 weeks. When it comes to tax relief, when it comes to the bloated budget of especially Washington state and other liberal governments, when it comes to mandates from the pandemic that went on for far too long, governors, Democratic governors clinging to emergency powers. And so what I wanted to impress upon the crowd is you have a lot of people like me who don't claim either political party, but who can be easily dissuaded right now from voting for Democrats. And I'll be honest, it is going to be very, very hard for any Democrat at any level to convince me to vote for them this year. Not impossible, but challenging. You know, there are some races where I know the Democratic candidates pretty well and where I really think they are in it for the right reasons. They're trustworthy, they're genuine, they're good people. And I would take that Democratic politician over a Republican who I'm not sure about their moral compass. I mean, 10 times out of 10. Sometimes I don't care if I don't agree with you on everything, but if I know you're a good, honest person, then I know what I'm going to get out of you, and it's not going to be a surprise. But that being said, especially with the public safety challenges and inflation and gas prices, it's going to be a really hard sell for me as a moderate for Democrats. But I am a moderate who is very, very in tune to what's happening in the state, in the nation, and in politics. Remember, not everyone is like that. Not everyone is like us. You guys are listening to a political podcast. You're someone who likes to be informed of the issues and who is likely, because of that, an informed voter. So what I was urging Republicans to do is to spend more time talking to people that aren't Republicans than people who are Republicans. Because I think if they can start those conversations, have those conversations in good faith, be willing to hash out reasonable disagreements, answer questions they have about Republican positions on things like abortion and other social issues, I think you will find that right now, the vast majority of moderates in our state would be inclined to vote for a Republican. And again, there are things, of course, there are things I don't agree with Republicans on. It's part of the reason why I don't consider myself a Republican. But for example, I'll just be frank, I am pro-choice. And I think that's true for a lot of the younger generation of folks who might have otherwise considered themselves Republican, is that we have a really hard time on some of the social issues getting on board because we've grown up in a different era. But even though I don't like, you know, conservative positions around women's reproductive rights, I also understand, and I talked about this on the podcast last week, that in Washington state, reproductive rights are not in question. Democrats want to try to convince and trick moderate voters into thinking they're in question, but they're really not. So if you're an informed Republican and you know that, and you know how to talk about that, and you know how to make your moderate friends understand that their abortion rights are not going to be taken away, that that's a distraction so Democrats don't have to confront other more pressing issues that they have an inability to deal with, then you've just convinced a moderate to vote for a Republican, at least this election. And that's all you need to do. It's not about turning someone into a Republican for life. It's about one election at a time. And if it sounds like I'm advocating for Republicans this time around, I will tell you that I am advocating for issues I believe in, and that's public safety. That is a non-vilification of the police, not tying the hands of law enforcement. That is trying to give a little bit of tax relief to people at a very difficult time. And right now, Republicans are the ones who are willing to do all of those things. And Democrats have shown that they're not. So it's just an interesting crowd. I think it was a mixed reception to having someone who wasn't a Republican be at the event, but I had a really good time there. And then on Sunday, I drove back from the central Washington, eastern Washington, and I went to the Washington State Libertarian Party's annual conference to give a speech to them. And I had a really good time. I was telling them, I was joking with them that The libertarians, I feel like, are the cool kids. And so the fact that they wanted me there, I felt like a fellow cool kid for a moment. But again, a similar situation. I told them I'm not a libertarian, but I do have some libertarian tendencies, as I think a lot of people do. This idea of the government just staying out of your lives, that's something that's embraced by Democrats when it comes to issues like abortion and other social issues. And it's something that's embraced by Republicans, certainly. I mean, true Republicans and conservatives who want limited government. And so there's some the interesting thing about libertarians is that they have a lot of overlap with both political parties. You know, they're in line with even leftist Democrats about policing and about drug laws and incarceration, but they're aligned with Republicans on things like the right to bear arms, overregulation, big government. So I find the libertarians incredibly fascinating. And I'll play a little bit of my remarks to them. One of the things I started off by saying is, yeah, I'm not a libertarian. However, first, I did vote for Joe Jorgensen in 2020 because it was just after that first horrendous debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. And I came away from that debate being like, I will never give either of those men my vote. And I had interviewed Joe Jorgensen when I was with Fox 13, and she was really nice, just seemed like a normal human being. And so I gave my vote to the one functioning adult on the ticket, and it was Joe Jorgensen. But I started off by talking to them about some of the similarities I see between myself now as an independent member of the media and their libertarian movement. I was at, like I said, the Republican dinner last night in Okanagan, and some gentleman came up to me after and said, "Why would you quit Fox? Why would you quit? You had such a big platform. You were with Fox News. You could have gone to Fox National. You could have had a show. Why would you walk away from a job like that?" And his thought was, you know, you had a bigger audience there. People already knew who you were, and now you're doing like a podcast and, you know, you're on Patreon. What is that? And to me, it's very similar to you guys here. You could easily be Republicans or Democrats. You could just say, you know what, I don't agree with everything, but they can win elections, right? They can win elections. They can raise money. I want that system around me, that corporation of a party around me to help me get into office. It'll be much easier to get into office, right? But you're not doing it because it's not true to who you are. So you're taking the difficult path and you're saying, no, I'm a freaking libertarian. And I don't care if I never get elected. I'm going to run as a libertarian and I'm going to be true to who I am and I'm going to spread my ideals. And it's the same with the decision that I made. I could have stayed with Fox. I could have continued making a lot of money, but it was not who I was. And it was not going to give me a feeling of accomplishment at the end of the day anymore. And so in that sense, I think we have a lot in common. You're doing what you think is right, what's true to you, and you should be commended for that. I understand it's not easy to operate outside the two-party system. I also, this is a question I have gotten from libertarian candidates in the past as to why the media doesn't cover them per se often, although I have covered a few. Obviously, I did an interview with Joe Jorgensen. So I laid out, and I think you might also find this interesting and helpful, so I wanted to play it. One of the questions I get is, how do newsrooms determine what candidates get attention and what candidates don't? Now, there's this false perception that newsrooms are somehow mandated by law to give equal coverage to all candidates. And that's not the case. That what you're thinking about is the fact that news stations who sell advertising, airtime, are required to, if I'm candidate A and I get 30 seconds for my political ad at X amount of dollars, then that station is required to give candidate B the opportunity to buy the same amount of airtime at the same cost. So that's where that comes into play. It has nothing to do with newsroom operations. It has to do with ad revenue and ad time. And so I wanted to talk to these libertarians about, you know, give them some advice on how you can get attention for your campaigns from the media, but also try to explain how the press goes about choosing what candidates to cover and what candidates they might not cover. And the reason that it's important for you to understand that is that media coverage can have a huge influence in races. Who the media decides through their various ways to pay attention to can have an enormous impact on the outcome of the race. And so here's what I explained to the Libertarian Party of Washington. The media has a couple standards for
determining, and I would say it varies by newsroom, but I can speak generally. Generally speaking, there are a few standards that I look to if I am going to cover a race to determine what candidates am I going to give a platform to. Because if you recall in 2020, there were, 30 gubernatorial candidates? Was it 30 or 35 or something? Obviously, I'm not going to sit them all down for an interview. So you have to put standards in place. Typically, the media will default to the leading Democrat, the leading Republican. But there's a few other things. My golden rule is my interview with you cannot do more for your campaign than you have done for your campaign. If just by virtue of me putting you on TV, it's going to give you a leg up, I'm not going to do that for you. So my rule has always been, are they putting in the work themselves? How active is their campaigning? How active is their fundraising? How active is their social media? Because again, I'm not going to do more work for you than you're willing to do for yourself. So if you're someone like a Lauren Culp, everybody's familiar with Lauren Culp, Republican candidate for governor, came in, nobody knew who he was. And so at first, none of us really paid attention to him. But then that man started getting a yard sign in every freaking driveway in the state. He built up this crazy social media following. And he did it without any help from the press, because they had a genius strategy to drum up name recognition and support. So I drove my ass 6 hours to Republic, Washington, and sat down and interviewed the man. He wasn't someone at the front end who I thought had a chance in the world of becoming the Republican nominee for governor, making it through the primary. But he showed, and he did the work to put it in. So to me, it's the hard and fast things, fundraising efforts, social media efforts, mailers, whatever have you. What are you doing to bring attention to your campaign? And unfortunately, and this is where there's a challenge for libertarians, name recognition is important as well. Prior political experience is important as well. Is this someone who people know? Name recognition is one of the number one things that helps get people elected. I don't like that it's that way, because it, I think, rules out the ability of a lot of highly qualified individuals who just haven't gotten their name out there to be able to get positions. But it is. So I look at all of those things.
So anyway, I talked to them about, you know, my politics and about also kind of the state of the media. But after I spoke, the crowd there heard from Spike Cohen, who, of course, is the party's 2020 vice presidential nominee. And he and I sat down for a lengthy interview after he got done speaking. We talked for more than an hour. I have to say, it was one of the more fascinating interviews I've done because, one, he's whip smart, very funny, very personable. I remarked to him a couple times how I've sat across from a lot of politicians, and very few of them you're able to have any sort of normal conversation with that doesn't feel stilted, doesn't feel forced. And so I spent some of my time with him asking him to sort of try to convince me about libertarian stances that I don't understand or don't agree with that would prevent me from identifying as a member of that party. But before I get to my interview with Spike Cohen, I want to take a minute to tell you about the founding sponsor of Undivided, 1530 Mortgage. 1530, in case you're curious, stands for the 15 and 30 year mortgage. And not only do they do new home loans, but they also do refinancing, which I know a lot of people right now with the economy, inflation, gas prices, they're considering, hey, should I cash in on the equity that I have in my home to try to help me get by, to try to help reduce debt? A lot of people are doing that right now. So if that's something that you're contemplating, 1530 Mortgage is a good first step. Reach out to them, 206-207-7777. Tell them Brandy sent you and you have questions that you want answered, or you can learn more about them at 1530mortgage.com. 1530 Mortgage, NMLS number 1761573, Equal Housing Opportunity. Now, as I was saying, I sat down with Spike Cohen, a notable libertarian, was the party's 2020 vice presidential nominee, and I kind of asked him to try to convince me about the party's stances on some things that I consider controversial. The two big ones for me are their belief that drugs, even hard drugs, should be decriminalized, and their stance on law enforcement. And so what resulted was a very reasonable, friendly, engaging conversation on those two issues. And so in the spirit of this show, which is meant to bridge political divides, I thought that was a particularly interesting part of the interview to play for you.
One of the things that, for me at least, feels like a non-starter is at least my, and correct me if I'm wrong, maybe I have misperceptions or conceptions about libertarian ideals, is the legalization of hard drugs. Pot, great. Smoke all the pot you want. But when I look at the streets of downtown Seattle and I see people overdosing on heroin in plain sight, I told you about my father who is a drug addict, alcoholic. I don't understand the desire to decriminalize or even legalize hard drugs.
So when we look at the opioid epidemic that is happening, we are seeing the final logical conclusion of the war on drugs. And we actually didn't need this to happen to know that. During alcohol prohibition, and by the way, I would taking a step back, I have been sober for 16 years. I was a drug addict of many different drugs for the better part of 10 years. I'm not a fan of drugs. I don't even drink coffee. So I'm not pro-drug. The reason I want to end the war on drugs is because of the harm that it's doing, not because I think drugs are good. I think that government trying to create a prohibition of something is creating a black market. So, for example, with alcohol, what happened? Alcohol, we knew that alcohol, people were dying of alcohol overdose. We knew that people who drank alcohol were most likely more likely to be jobless or have job issues. They were more likely to be spousal abusers. They were more likely to be, to end up in jail for various other crimes. And so between that and the Christian morality that existed during that time, then, you know, we kind of decided, okay, well, we're going to ban alcohol at the federal level. Immediately, what happened was everyone stopped drinking alcohol. No, the exact opposite happened.
Yes.
It all went underground. The demand didn't go away, but now the supply, by government fiat, the government mandated that the only way you could get the alcohol you wanted was from criminals who don't care about the quality of the product. They don't care about your well-being. So suddenly we saw massive amounts of violence in the streets. We saw these people that were previously two-bit thugs that were making money from the protection racket. Now they were effectively billionaires. They were corrupting governments, paying off politicians, putting their preferred politicians and police officers in charge to look the other way. And when they ended that, when they ended alcohol prohibition, almost immediately we saw a reduction in violent crime. We saw a reduction in the overdose deaths. It didn't go away entirely, and it was never going to go away because there are people that have vices. There are people that have mental health issues, chronic health issues, and everything else that leads them into being addicted and all the things that come from that. That's never going to completely go away. But when we criminalize the act, the actual, what is often a medical, mental health, or physical health problem that leads to that being done and turn it into a criminal problem, we are criminalizing people who are not hurting others. We are empowering people who do hurt others, and we're corrupting government in the process and making people less trustworthy of government.
See, I disagree, though, that it doesn't hurt other people. You go to downtown Seattle, we have all these small businesses that cannot survive. They are being, shoplifted blind. Some of them can't afford to hire private security. Police are underfunded in Seattle. You might argue with underfunding. We'll get to that in a second. But so I guess I disagree with the notion that drug use doesn't harm other people.
Right. So if I get drunk, I'm more likely to do all of many different things, right?
And you can kill me in a car accident.
I'm getting more likely to kill you in a car accident, more likely to get into a fight with someone. One of the things with cannabis, you're more likely to just sit on the couch, right?
But get fat, those are snacks.
But the thing is, when you are doing, you know, when you're heroin, meth, these drugs, very often you end up losing everything else in your life. You're now trying to feed this habit. Often you've lost other things in your life, which has led to you becoming addicted. And so now you're just robbing people, or you're more likely to be violent. You're more likely to be homeless and all the problems that are created from that. The drug itself wasn't the problem. It was all the ancillary things that come from that. But again, we have to look at the root cause of what caused that. I can't tell you how many people I met on the campaign trail. They had either a mental health crisis or a physical problem, like they got into an accident or something like that. They ended up on prescription opioids. The FDA set an arbitrary limit for the number of opioids they can have for the entire rest of their life. So now they've still got the pain problem. They've now got an opioid habit. But now they can't get them legally. So now they're moving towards black market pills, which now are becoming less and less safe, things like fentanyl and other things like that. Even if you are getting the correct pill dosage and it's from an actual like reputable person who made it, you're not under doctor supervision. And then one day you realize, you know what would be a lot cheaper than this? Black tar heroin. And if you've already lost everything else in your life, you don't even care anymore.
When you talk about, you know, not putting these drug users in jail or, you know, do all these things, Seattle doesn't. And Seattle hasn't for some time. We had a city attorney who essentially legalized personal possession of any kind of narcotic.
Yes.
And so you do not have police making drug arrests. You do not have prosecutors prosecuting drug arrests unless it's a possession with intent to deliver. And Seattle is worse than it has ever been.
Right.
And there are people who blame the lax enforcement of drug laws.
Yeah.
So what is it, as a Seattleite, I'm thinking, I feel like I've seen drug decriminalization in action, and I don't like the result of it.
You've seen a local level drug decriminalization where the drug war still exists and creates all those things. The addicts are still becoming addicts because of the FDA not letting them work directly with a doctor to get the pain meds that they need. The people that are being criminalized because of the war on drugs, and not just the war on drugs, but other problems in criminal justice, that leads to people becoming criminalized, which includes a tremendous number of veterans. One out of every 10 people that is in prison is a veteran. And it's an even higher number for those that are homeless. They are disproportionately wildly overrepresented in those. And that's largely because of the wars overseas and then the poor way that they're treated through the Veterans Administration, so-called
healthcare. We can agree on that.
Yeah.
We can agree on that.
How odd that the most government-managed form of healthcare in this country happens to also be the absolute worst form of healthcare in this country. And so there are many factors that lead to that. And yes, if all of these other things exist, and in the middle of it they go, well, yeah, I guess... yeah, it's okay if you do that, then that's going to lead a bunch of people to go there so that they can do those drugs. The answer is not simply just removing this thing or this thing. The answer is looking at this as the holistic problem that it is.
I've seen libertarians talk about police states.
Yes.
I don't feel like Seattle's a police state. What is your view on policing and where it needs to go?
So I believe the reason I say that we live generally in a police state.
My dad used to say that all the time, by the way. I think you guys would have got along,
yes.
got along great.
Well, there you go. So the reason I say that we're in a police state, and I won't compare us to like living in Chinese, communist Chinese or something like that. But the reason I say we're in a police state is because we have more rules and regulations than almost any other country on earth. Like on a daily basis, the way that you live your life is more governed than you may even realize, because we often convince ourselves that we're free. We're actually just really well domesticated at this point. But we have more regulations than almost anyone else on earth. We also have a higher prison population than any other country on earth, including communist China. We have more people in jail, many of them for crimes like drug possession, drug distribution, which usually means having it in more than one bag, and other what we consider victimless crimes, where in and of themselves no victim was created by that. And it hasn't made us any safer. We aren't safer as a result of it. And then another aspect of why I call us a police state is, unlike in a lot of other countries, there is very little accountability unless it rises to a certain point.
For police.
If a police officer murders someone, there's a increasingly higher likelihood that they'll be prosecuted for that. Although for a long time, that wasn't the case, because we weren't all walking around with HD video cameras, and it was, you know, he said, she said, and if she's dead and he's not, then you know, you see how that goes. But because of things like qualified immunity, because of things like police unions who just doggedly defend even the worst actors among them, which signals to the good actors in police departments that, you know, hush up and don't say anything because we're going to defend the bad actors and punish you for saying anything about it. These things lead to police perceiving that they don't have to do anything to stay accountable, and the public perceiving that as well. So that is why I say that we're a police state. I don't believe in any society, even in the libertarian utopian society, there's going to be a need for security. There are always going to be bad actors. But that security, whatever that looks like, needs to focus on protecting the lives, rights, and property of the people that they are serving. And when they do bad actions, when they violate lives and rights and property, they need to be held at least as accountable as the rest of us are, if not more so, because they have a special license to enforce these things that the rest of us don't necessarily have. And I think they should be held at least as accountable as they are, as we would be, and they often are not right now.
Well, and see, I don't disagree with that. And I have been very pro-police. I think people would consider me pro-police.
Yeah.
But it's always been pro-good police.
Well, and to me, no one's pro-bad cop.
What I'm saying is, you know, I think that I sometimes get lost in that libertarian, you know, police state as almost a vilification of law enforcement, where, you know, I want, and I agree with you, that you gave some, that person has a badge and a gun. They can take someone's life. What a tremendous, profound power that is. But it doesn't come across to me as libertarians having respect and appreciation and empathy for the many, many good police officers who are doing really difficult jobs. Do you think it's a noble profession?
I think policing can be a noble profession.
Okay.
My concern is that right now, with the laws that we have in place, with the regulatory structure that we have in place, for many police officers, including many libertarian police officers that I speak with on a regular basis, so much of their job is a combination of enforcing victimless crime laws and raising revenue on motorists
okay.
that it is less of their job, less and less of their job becomes defending lives, rights, and property, serving the public, what they signed up for. Very similar dynamic to people who sign up to protect the country and then find themselves on the other side of the planet wondering, what am I protecting here? Why am I here? Very similar dynamic with a lot of police officers. They signed up to protect the public. They signed up to, you know, protect and serve and to protect the people's lives and rights and property and, you know, find the bad guys and punish them. And they find themselves doing a lot of stuff that isn't that.
But they do a lot of, I mean, me, it seems inherently like a noble profession. I mean, I don't want to show up at a scene where someone's been shot.
Of course.
I don't want to go save someone, you know, who's being raped or whatever.
Absolutely.
So to me, when I hear you pause about whether it's a noble profession, as someone who leans right, it's a turnoff.
Okay. So I will say this. I think that a lot of the people who do it go into it for the most noble of reasons.
Okay.
I mean, yes, there are jerks who go into it so they can flex their muscles. But I think for the most part that the people that are going into it are going into it for the right reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Again, similar to people that are joining the military. They're going in for the right reasons. What do we hear? They want to protect the public. It's been something that has been in their family, you know, long family. You know, my dad was a cop, his dad was a cop, and so forth.
Yeah.
We hear a lot of, you know, it's a solid and stable profession. It's something, you know, job security and all of that. People go into it for good reasons. Why I pause is because if your job is also to enforce all these other laws, it's hard for me to unequivocally say this is a noble thing to do. I think that the things that we want them to do. So, for example, when I will talk about, you know, my criticisms of policing, and someone says, they'll say, well, the next time you get robbed, I guess you should call a crackhead, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
They never say the next time that you want to get pulled over and harassed because you didn't know your taillight was out and they hit you with a $200 fine, or the next time that your buddy is smoking a joint and they, you know, arrest them and, you know, put them in jail over the weekend and then, you know, give them an $800 fine, you know, call someone else. They always talk about the things we actually want police to do.
The worst case scenario.
Yeah,
I can understand that.
Without just worst case scenario, the things we actually want cops to do exclusively. We want them to protect ourselves, our lives, our rights, our property, those who are defenseless, those who need help. We want them to be there if someone is lost. We want them to, you know, we want them to do those things.
So that, again, is part of my conversation with Spike Cohen, the 2020 vice presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party. Now, one of the other reasons I really wanted to sit down with him is, after all the mandates, you know, 2 years in the pandemic and in Washington, at least, crushing mandates that were unprecedented, I really feel as if there is a moment for libertarians to seize on that frustration people had with what was perceived as government overreach. And maybe the libertarian movement could grow a little bit as a result. And so Spike Cohen and I spent a lot of time talking about how libertarians would have responded to the pandemic. If you'd like to watch our full interview, you can do that by becoming an undivided subscriber on my Patreon page or my Locals page. That interview will be up this evening. It's brandycruz.locals.com or Patreon, patreon.com/undivided. Again, my full interview with Spike Cohen will be available exclusively for subscribers tonight on my Patreon and Locals pages. That's it for this episode of the Undivided Podcast. I do hope that your takeaway from all of this is a renewed enthusiasm for speaking to people who you don't agree with politically. And maybe you can't convince them to align with your politics. Maybe they'll convince you to align more so with their politics and their ideology. But at the end of the day, there really is, when you approach a conversation with someone you don't agree with an open heart and an open mind and an eagerness to learn and to understand, you realize that these are not only interesting conversations to have, they can be really fun, they can be really enjoyable, and you can leave knowing more about the political spectrum than when you began. And for us kind of politics nerds, I think that's really fun. Thank you for those who have subscribed to not only the podcast, but to my Patreon and Locals pages. And thank you to all of you who are interested in giving common sense a comeback. And another thanks to the founding sponsor of Undivided 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com.